I screw everything up and I have no idea why. Stage two is I still screw everything up, but now I know why. And stage three is I start to see my screw ups before I make them, and then I adjust around them.
Welcome to Your Intended Message, the perfect place for leaders and promising professionals who want to convey the intended message for greater success. Every week, we interview experts who address the challenges and best practices to deliver your message effectively. That might be one-to-one, one-to-few, or one-to-many. And perhaps the most important conversation, one-to-self. I'm your host, George Torok. My guest today is Ed Rush. Here's three facts that I think you should know about Ed. One, he was an F-18 fighter pilot who flew over 50 combat missions. While with the Marines, he was a leading instructor in aerial dogfighting. Scary stuff. Second, he now is a speaker, a writer, and an advisor on how to boost dramatically profitability in business. Three, he is a five-time best-selling author. And four, here's a bonus point. He did all that despite failing kindergarten. Ed Rush, welcome to Your Intended Message.
George, it's awesome to be here, man. And you know, that last bullet, I don't, you know, like admitting that in public, but that time in my life, by the way, all of my kids, except for my last, I've a 16-year-old, a 14-year-old, a 12-year-old, and a 2-year-old. Everybody except the last one has already graduated from kindergarten. My oldest daughter graduated from kindergarten with honors. And I realized, you know, how dumb do you have to be to fail this grade? Well, apparently pretty dumb, because it's content like stacking blocks and not eating glue. So I always knew that I had to follow the experts to be successful. And you'll be happy to know I did in fact graduate from kindergarten, made it all the way through college actually, before I made my way into the Marine Corps to be a fighter pilot. But it's just an honor to be on your show, George. We've been talking about this, I know, for about a month now, and it's just really cool to be here with you on this excellent broadcast. So let's get it going, man.
Now, I'm curious about the kindergarten challenge, because I think it's not so much about intelligence as probably motivation and interest.
Yeah, or following instructions. So I make a joke about failing kindergarten, and I really did. But, you know, our school system is designed for 8% of the kids that get into the classroom. I mean, the idea that you're going to stand in front of someone and talk to them about something, like, we would never do that as pilots. Could you imagine if the only training we ever received as pilots was someone standing up on a whiteboard saying, you know, and here's how you land an airplane, and here's how you get to the aircraft carrier, we would all die, you know? So experiential knowledge is the best thing that you can get. The idea of apprenticeships that really have gone out the window largely, you know, and our entire school system is based on, you know, people standing up and teaching from a whiteboard. And then we can't figure out why our kids don't even know, like, you know, when our, you know, the Declaration of Independence was signed or whatever. But anyway, that's a side road. My point is, it wasn't designed for me. I was a more experiential kind of hands-on kind of kid with a lot of energy. And I spent a lot of time in trouble all the way through school. But now I'm here as an entrepreneur, which means I get to do trouble for my business. Okay. So there we are.
Now, Ed, with someone starting out that way, I wonder, what was it that drove you to become a fighter pilot? Because that takes a lot of concentration, motivation, skill building. Did the challenge scare you?
Oh, a little bit. I mean, here's the thing. When I watched the movie, so I was taken in an airplane when I was 11 years old by my step-grandfather, my stepmom's father. He took me up in a Cessna twin-engine Golden Eagle and handed me the controls of the airplane, and I fell in love with flying in that exact moment. The world was totally different. I had control over three dimensions, which wasn't all that normal for me, and I loved it, and I wanted to be a pilot. And then in 1995, I believe is the year. No, sorry, 1991, I think, if I remember. Maybe it was even in the late 80s. I think it was early 90s. A movie came out called Top Gun. When that movie came out, everybody wanted to be a fighter pilot. And it's funny, George, the way you think about yourself. When I was in high school, I thought, well, there go my chances. Now everyone's going to want to do it. So therefore, I won't be able to. I didn't know at the time that I was particularly gifted, frankly, at being able to fly airplanes. I thought I was pretty average. You know, I was the guy that failed the kindergarten. But when I was in college, I was a college baseball player, and I was planning on going into the professional baseball and playing or coaching. And I was walking through the cafeteria one day, and there was this guy standing there with this khaki shirt with all these medals hanging off of it. And he had this weird white hat and these blue pants with a red stripe. What's that all about? And the shiniest shoes I've ever seen, artificially shiny, a little weird, actually, when I look back on it. And he looked at me and he said, hey, do you ever want to fly airplanes? And I'm like, actually, I do want to fly airplanes. And literally the next thing I knew, George, I was in boot camp, which felt like a bad decision at the time. But it turned out to be a really good decision. My whole family, nobody had any military experience. There was only one person in my entire family who had any military experience, especially as a pilot. My great uncle George, my grandmother's brother, flew in World War II, took off and disappeared. They never heard from him ever again. The assumption was he crashed into the desert of North Africa. And that's the only experience my entire family had with pilots in the military. And so, as you might imagine, it came as quite a shock to my entire family that I was going into the military. Most of them cried at my commissioning. The Marines at the commissioning thought they were tears of joy. They weren't. They all thought I was going to die. But as you can tell, I didn't die. Here I am today having served in the military for 11 years active duty, 20 years as a reservist. And now I write books and help people change their life. So it's been pretty good, frankly. And I'm just, you know, joined at the process. And yeah, I was a little nervous here and there, but I was more nervous, frankly. I wasn't nervous so much about crashing or getting hurt. I was nervous about screwing up. I mean, as a pilot, that's worse, you know, screwing up is worse than anything. And that's at least the way we think. So there you go.
Ed, what would you say was the most valuable lessons that the Marines taught you other than flying? What you know, other than how to fly the plane? And what I mean by that, valuable life lessons.
Yeah, yeah. I'll give you two. The first one is I learned in the military, but I learned to describe it better from a friend of mine named Perry Marshall. And the phrase goes like this: fail fast, next. Life is full of frustrating failures. Most entrepreneurs I know fail 8 to 9 times for every one success. In the military, as a pilot, the interesting thing about pilots is you see an airplane come flying by, whoosh, 400 miles an hour, and it looks so smooth and pristine and precise. But if you were to watch that pilot nice and close, you were to watch the pilot's right hand, their left hand, and their feet, and especially their eyeballs, you would see someone who's making about 10 corrections every second. You would see the airplane is constantly making adjustments, or the pilot is constantly making adjustments to the airplane. You would see their eyes moving back and forth and checking everything and maintaining what looks like a perfectly level airplane that's being controlled at a very micro level. These tiny little adjustments are what creates smooth. So smooth doesn't create it from an airplane that's flying at 400 miles an hour and a pilot's sipping, you know, a latte as the airplane's turning. You're making these tiny little corrections. And if you were to sit there and actually hold on lightly to the stick, say you were in the back seat of an airplane that had two control systems, you would actually feel that thing moving around quite a bit. The pilot would be making these tiny little adjustments, tiny corrections. I recently had the opportunity to race cars in Atlanta. I was racing Porsches. And it's a similar in the car. If you are sitting in a car, you could be perfectly calm driving down the road at 130, 150 miles an hour. But if you look down, you'd see you're making these little tiny corrections to the steering wheel that you didn't even notice you were making because your eyes are down the road trying to maintain the car. And so the first one, I think, George, would be fail fast, next. The tiny little corrections that get you to success. Most entrepreneurs who are experienced understand that. Most entrepreneurs who are new tend to get frustrated when things don't go their way. Well, guess what? It never goes your way. Like, you know, you're always constantly making adjustments to your business and your business plan and your goals and your marketing and your communication style and your product suite and all those sort of things. The second one I think that's really important is the concept of avoiding mistakes early. So we always used to teach young pilots. And when we were teaching young pilots, we had what we called three stages of learning. Stage number one for a young pilot was, sounds like this. I screw everything up and I have no idea why. Stage two is I still screw everything up, but now I know why. And stage three is I start to see my screw ups before I make them and then I adjust around them. And so part of being an entrepreneur really is developing the experience or the pattern recognition to be able to see the mistakes that you're about to make and, hey, I've done that one before, and adjust around those mistakes to see yourself towards success.
When you fly an F-18 jet, your ability to communicate with the plane, with the commander, with your other fellow pilots, how do you keep that active without distracting yourself?
Yeah, I mean, so the first thing is there's a lot of distractions. When you're in an airplane like ours, you've got one, two, sometimes three radios. You've got a very complicated navigation system, a radar, forward-looking infrared. The stick itself has one, two, three, four, five, six different switches on it. The throttles themselves, there's two throttles in the F-18 because you have a left and a right engine. There's one button for each of your fingers, and there's about four buttons for your thumb. So there's a lot of options, you know? We have a little mouse system with our finger and that you can move on different screens and move it back and forth. And so we used to have in the cockpit, sometimes people call it a finger fire. Sometimes you can't get the thing to where you want it to, and you know, your fingers don't work the way that they want to. And so, yeah, the world in the cockpit is a very distractible world. There's a lot of input, and filtering all through all that input is really important. The entrepreneurial world, by the way, is very distraction centered world as well. Now, one of the ways that pilots learn to thrive with the kind of distraction, I mean, I was just talking about flying an airplane. I'm not even talking about a bombing run or a dogfight or being shot at while you're trying to do a bombing run. Or, I mean, there's a lot of things that can come your way as a pilot. And so one of the ways in which we overcome that challenge is by training tasks, conscious mind tasks into our subconscious or unconscious mind. Let me give you an example. The conscious mind is the one that we're using right now to have this conversation as we look each other in the eye and talk about our mutual businesses and the things that I'm communicating, conscious mind, the things that you're communicating, your conscious mind. But at the same time, while I'm sitting here, I'm sitting on top of a stool that actually moves right and left, and I'm actually kind of balancing on this stool. Now, I haven't really thought about that until I just managed to mention it. That's actually happening while I'm talking to you with my conscious mind. You see, my subconscious mind is doing that work. If I was standing, for example, right now, there would be little micro adjustments that my feet and my ankles would be making and my legs and my hips would be making to keep me vertical. So the process of standing is an amazingly complex anatomical exercise that takes us as human beings quite some time to master. I don't know, you know, if you have kids or if you've even ever seen kids, I'm just kidding. I know, but you know, with four kids, you watch them learn to stand. That process takes some time. I'll take, for example, driving. When I teach my daughter who's learning how to drive, when I teach her to drive, the first step of driving after you start the car is to put the car into reverse or into drive. As a 16-year-old learning to drive, you remember that took some time to learn how to shift the car into drive, or shift the car into drive, or if you were in a manual like I was, just shift it into first gear. Like, you had to think about that. But then 6 months later, you didn't think about that. And you know as well as I do, when you get into a car now, you don't think about shifting into drive. You don't think about turning the radio on. It just all happens. That's because it's a subconscious practice. So as a pilot, the first thing you do is learn to fly the airplane. And then you learn to fly it so that you're not thinking about flying. You're thinking about something else. Then you learn to land and take off. And then you learn how to do that in a subconscious way. So you're not really paying attention to that part of it. So you free up conscious mind processing for something else. And just like you're driving a car down the highway, you're not thinking about those little corrections anymore. You're not thinking necessarily about the lane change anymore. Those things are becoming more subconscious for you. So you do have time now to maybe talk on the phone while you're in the car. Think about that. That's crazy. You're driving 80 miles an hour. You're talking to somebody who's not even with you. That is a very complicated thing to do, but you've made it simple because it's a subconscious process. And so when I teach entrepreneurs, part of what I teach is how to take the complex tasks of being an entrepreneur and turn those into conscious processing. So for example, communication and persuasion for a entrepreneur should be second nature. The words that you say should be so well prepared and rehearsed that you've done them before that they just start to come out on their own without you even really thinking about them all that much. Your ability to communicate via email or via social media, those things should begin to become more subconscious. Your ability to lead your team and to be an example for those around you, those things should start to become more of a subconscious process so that you can free some of your conscious mind to be able to do those things. And that's really, as a pilot, how we eliminate some distraction. And as an entrepreneur, certainly how you do it as well.
As a motorcycle rider.
That's me.
I can certainly identify with what moving to the subconscious. There's just things you do. And I noticed that recently I've been shooting some video while I've been riding. And then when I look at the video later, I see me making little adjustments I wasn't aware of.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Wasn't conscious of.
I mean, if you think, like, if you ever watch those guys on the Isle of Skye that drive those motorcycles, I can guarantee you 90% of the gear shifts happen without them even thinking about it. At the point at which you become an elite motorcyclist like that, you're shifting the gear based on the sound of the engine and how it feels. And I'm telling you, I guarantee you, they're not even thinking about it. The thing they're probably thinking about the most is where their sight picture is going, what their reference point is going to be. If you've raced, you know, as you come around a corner, you're going to pick a reference point that's not the road in front of you or not the motorcycle, something really far out. And you begin to move your trajectory based off that. And then maybe they're thinking about like their gas or when they're going to stop. I mean, there's a lot of things that are happening, you know, at 200 miles an hour that they're not even consciously processing. And that's life, you know? So the better you can learn how to do that, the more successful you'll be, frankly.
Now, I'm curious, and you triggered a thought. When you're flying, an F-18 or any plane for that matter, there are times when you're simply looking at sky. How do you focus on sky?
Well, it's interesting. So the airplane's moving around quite a bit. And I would say you probably never spend more than a half second with your attention on any given thing. Even if you're fighting an airplane in front of you, you may be looking at the airplane, come back in, look at your airspeed. You may look at the airplane, maybe look over your right-hand shoulder to see where your wingman is, but look back at the airplane, back down to your weapon system. So your eyes are moving really quickly when you're scanning. Again, I go back to like when you're racing cars, I said, there's a sight line. You know, they teach when you first learn to race, they teach you come around the corner and then look for a sight. What I found is, yeah, you come around the corner, you look for something, and then your eyes go, and you're always kind of going back to that one thing, but your eyes are just bouncing all over the place. That's a true scan. So yeah, you don't really focus. There's nothing out there anyway, unless you're looking for an airplane. And in that case, like if you're looking out in the sky, looking for air, sometimes you're trying to see an airplane out at 3 or 5 miles, you know, before they see you. And then what you're doing there is you're really actually scanning pieces of sky. You're not even looking at the sky, by the way. You're looking at the space in between you and the sky when you're looking for your airplane. So yeah, it's an interesting question. I haven't gotten to ask that question. I like that. Very good. Mm. Very interesting interview. Thank you.
Scariest moment for you? What was it?
Oh my goodness. So my first night carrier landing. So here's the way the carrier landings work. There are 9 countries in the world that fly off of aircraft carriers. England, China, India, just to name a few. The only country that does it at night is the United States of America. Okay. Now, some people call that courage and bravery. I call it sheer stupidity. Unbelievably insane. I mean, landing on a moving boat, a boat that's moving through the water in the day is nuts. To do it at night, it's unbelievable. I ask guys with hundreds of carrier landings. I'm talking guys who've been out flying with the Navy for 10 plus years. And I said, do you ever get used to landing at night? They're like, never. During the day, they really start to get comfortable. They enjoy it. Never, ever, ever at night. And when you do it at night, for the first time in training, you're alone. Normally, we have an instructor in our backseat. But when you do it alone, you're alone. And I had a condition on my first landing that can only be described as vertigo. When I descended into the clouds about 10 miles behind the aircraft carrier at 1,200 feet, a condition came upon me that made me feel like I was turning to the left. And every pilot, when they feel their airplane turning to the left, starts to go to the right. I looked up at my heads-up display, my primary reference, and it told me that I was flying straight and level. And the short version of the story is, as the closer I got to landing, the more this picked up harder and harder until I felt at any moment like I was going to crash. Now, the inside part of the story is, if I had actually turned to the right, I would have crashed the airplane. It was my internal sense that was off that particular day. Yeah, I thought I was going to die. I thought at any minute I was going to see the ocean and then smash into it and die as a young 24-year-old pilot. And it was the concept, trust your instruments, that saved me that day. That my instructor, who had been told by his instructor, who had been told by her instructor back to the beginning of the instrumented flight, to trust your instruments. My instructor said, trust your instruments. Your instrument's going to be there for you. You'll make mistakes in the airplane, but if you trust your instruments, you'll be safe. And that was good advice. That's life-saving advice. And when I rolled out of the aircraft carrier that day on the USS Stennis here in San Diego, my stomach was in a knot. There was sweat pouring down my face. But I was alive because of an idea, a good idea. And so ever since then, I've been on the hunt for good ideas, those great life-changing ideas. And I found some. And that's what I've been teaching since then. Life-changing ideas that make a huge difference for you and everyone around you.
Trust your instruments. How can that lesson relate to business?
Yeah, so I would start with this. Trust your instruments was one really, really good idea. In fact, it was a life-saving idea. But trust your instruments, it wasn't worth the paper it's printed on without implementation or action. So the first thing I teach my entrepreneurs is, like, when you go to an event or you read a book or you go to a blog or you listen to a great podcast like this one or you watch a YouTube video, you're not there to get 100 ideas or even 10. You're there to walk away with one good idea that you can implement. Most entrepreneurs, when they start out, they approach business in an amateur fashion. An amateur may or may not. But a pro does. So if you teach a pro, they're going to take your strategy and they're going to implement it. If you approach a pro baseball player and they're having trouble with their swing and you give them an idea on something they can do with their grip, that pro is going to give that a shot. Now, it might work and it might not work, but a professional will take that idea. And if it works, they're going to keep using it. And if it doesn't work, they're going to adjust and move to something else. They're going to be like a missile that's making constant adjustments on their way to the target. A pro, a professional business person, not an amateur, professional entrepreneur will find a new idea and they will implement it. So if I say, hey, you know what you should probably do? Maybe you should write a book. Maybe you should start a podcast. Maybe you should grow your social media platform. Maybe you should try a landing page and maybe some paid ads on Facebook. Maybe you should launch a product or have an event or start a coaching program. A professional entrepreneur will take that idea that they were given and they will filter it through all the other ideas that they're given and they'll choose out of that stack of ideas, one good idea, one idea that they can implement and take into completed action. And at that point, if it works, they'll keep doing it. And if it doesn't work, they're going to adjust and try something else. Like I said, most entrepreneurs fail 8-9 times out of every 10. That's okay, because each of those failures is leading you closer to the one decision that's going to be a success that you're going to do over and over and over again. And I'll tell you, I've made millions of dollars off of decisions that worked that I kept doing over and over and over again. So I like the idea of one good idea. And it also takes a little bit of the pressure off, frankly. Most entrepreneurs I know, at least most people who come to me as clients, they have maybe 100 things they're doing and then another 100 that they're not doing, but they feel guilty that they're not doing. And sometimes what I do with businesses is you know, streamline them so that they maybe have 2 or 4 things that they're focused on.
Perhaps you've already done it, but you raised a point about life-changing ideas. And I imagine that what you just told us is one of those, but what other 1, 2, or 3 life-changing ideas can you offer to entrepreneurs?
Yeah. I mean, the one that I mentioned about failing falls right behind the one that I just said about one good idea, right? The second, okay, so the first one was one good idea implemented. The second one was fail fast next. The third one is to look at your business essentially as one of 2 operations. every business is a lead generation business and a customer acquisition business, right? So for example, if you have a business, you show me a business that has no lead generation. What I mean by leads is anybody who approaches you and says, hey, I'm interested in what you have. And a customer is that person after they paid you, okay? So a lead could be a person who comes to your website. A lead could be a person who listens to your podcast. A lead could be someone who goes to your social media channel. A lead could be somebody who gives you their email address. A lead could be somebody who calls your office and tries to schedule an appointment. A lead could be somebody who sends you an email and asks you a little bit more about one of your products. The lead could be someone who shows up at your page looking at one of your products. Those are all leads. The point at which they take a credit card out or a checkbook and they pay you for something is when they become a customer. And every business, by its essence, is a lead generation business and a customer acquisition business. You take away lead generation, there's no business. You take away customer acquisition, there's no business. So I'll get quite often, I will get questions from people who will say, hey, Ed, I'm just starting out in business. What should I have, an S corp or an LLC? And I have an answer to that question, by the way, but what I usually say to them is, let me ask you a question. If I handed you a check for $1 million right now, would you go figure out the answer to that on your own? Of course you would. You'd be able to find an attorney or an accountant or somebody who could give you good advice on business, on how to set up your business. So the key isn't how to set your business up. The key is to get the $1 million, okay? The idea is to create value in the marketplace so that you get an exchange of value and start to build the revenue of your business. Fundamentally, every business is in the business of creating value for its shareholders. Most shareholders are you, the entrepreneur. So step one is to create value for you as the entrepreneur. That's not a selfish thing. If you want to hire employees, if you want to hire outside contractors, if you want to be able to support a charity, you're going to need to have revenue, period. Okay, that's just the way business works. I know our world doesn't like talking about that much, but that's because our world is still in kindergarten, okay? And when you grow up and mature as a person, you understand that the world works in a value exchange. The world does not work based on what you want it to work. It works on value. So when someone buys an iPhone, they're not buying it because of the hours that went into it. They're buying it because of the value that they perceive it's going to bring into their life. When somebody spends $179 on this, if you're listening to the podcast, I'm holding up a set of AirPods, okay? When somebody spends an exorbitant amount of money to buy this set of AirPods, they're not doing it because of how many hours went into it. They're doing it because of the perceived value in their life. They exchange their value for something they perceive as of a greater value. That's the way their world really works. So as a business owner, your job is to communicate value into the marketplace in such a way that you get more leads and more customers, or more of the right leads and more of the right customers, so that they can become lifelong customers and so that you can build revenue in your business so that you can provide a return on to your shareholders. And like I said, businesses do only two things. I mentioned the one, which is to provide a return to the shareholder. The second thing every great business does is provides value in excess of what you receive, right? So for example, if I get $20,000 from a coaching member, I should therefore be able to give value in excess of the money that they gave me. And that's why people come back year after year after year, because they get more value.
You're stressing value, and I'm guessing you have noticed some business owners, entrepreneurs who get it wrong. Where do they get the value equation?
Here's where they get it. Most of the time they get it wrong. So most heart-centered entrepreneurs provide value. Okay. So that when I spoke about value, I either said value or perceived value. Now, this is where the separation comes between these two. At the point at which a transaction happens, perceived value turns into true value. Okay, so let me give you an example. If somebody signs up with me, one of my courses, it's called Top Gun Consulting. In this course, the course is about $2,000, but in the course, I guarantee that person's gonna make at least $5,000 from what they learn over the first 2 months, okay? So when they sign up and do the course, they should make $5,000. The value proposition is you invest $2,000, you're gonna make $5,000, or you can have your money back, which is basically kind of a no-brainer. Up until the point at which the person makes the transaction, the value in their future is only perceived in the sense that they haven't experienced that value yet, and they're not going to unless they make their initial decision to buy the product. So up until this point, there's no real value exchange. I mean, they've gotten content from me and teaching from me and that sort of thing. But there's not, there hasn't been a value exchange because they didn't buy anything from me. And therefore, they haven't been given anything that I have to sell for sale. So there's perceived value here, right? So the perceived value of a product is important. How they see the future result of your product or your service or your consulting or whatever is as important as what they actually get, right? Because look, you could have the best product in the world. You could have a car that goes 300 miles an hour and runs off of solar power and, you know, never needs gas and has the best safety system in the world. And, you know, like has all the belt, never need to change the tires, never have to service the engine. You could have like the best car in the world, but if nobody knows about it, you will literally have a broke business with the best car in the world. Okay. And GM or Ford will beat you every year because nobody perceives or sees the value. Now, once the transaction happens, then there's the value exchange. And so I always tell people, look, your job as an entrepreneur, very simple, is to under-promise and over-deliver so that when they get the value over here, they look and they're like, wow, this is better than I thought it was going to be, right? So the perceived value is here and it's even better, but this should be pretty high. This perceived value should be pretty high. And most entrepreneurs, in my experience, don't fail here. They give great value. The problem is they don't know how to communicate the benefit to the subscriber or the customer in such a way that the person really wants what they have. And so what ends up happening is they have competitors in the marketplace who are out marketing them, who have inferior products, but better marketing. And they have a higher sales and higher market value, not because their product's better, but because their marketing is better. So one of the things I do with my coaching and consulting clients is you and I work to make sure your marketing equals the actual value of your product in the marketplace, because it's almost always less. I've yet to find one business. I've worked with 476 now, one-on-one companies, one-on-one. I've yet to find a single business who is over-marketing. It just doesn't happen. Most people undersell themselves, their product, their service, their result in the marketplace.
Why do you think that is? Why do they undersell themselves?
It's mostly because of how they view themselves, frankly. A lot of it has to do with how they view money. Most people, you know, we're told money doesn't grow on trees, or, you know, most people feel like, I don't want to like hype my product up, but most people never get close to being able to get there. I mean, some people do, but those are called unethical people. And I don't work with folks like that, you know? So the people I work with are almost always underselling themselves. And mostly, by the way, George, mostly it's a reaction. So people see like the late night infomercial hype and they're like, well, I don't ever want to do that. And they retreat way past the point that they should have retreated. They go way over here and they're like, if you just want to like learn about me, like give me a call. And there's no real marketing. There's no discussion of the benefit to the person. So it's fun conversation.
I'm curious, Ed. So do you help or do you encourage people to be bolder with their message?
Almost always. Like I said, I have, in all those clients I've worked with, I've never had to say to somebody, pull it back. I've never had anyone overpromising. My experience is that most people artificially hold themselves back. By the way, it's one of the reasons why I do a lot of work as a copywriter, where I'll come in and write copywriting campaigns for businesses. And I can almost always write a better campaign than the person can write about themselves. And that's true for me, by the way. I've had people who wrote better campaigns for me too, right? Because a lot of times you're like, I don't know. I don't want to say that. We have a big false humility thing going on right now. And people are like, oh, I don't know. I don't want to be, you know, and they don't push their marketing. And I tell people, like, I've went, like, one of my clients is this, these two women that help women who have husbands who have Alzheimer's. So these women are in their 70s and they are coaches, consultants for women whose husbands are diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Two of the nicest people in the world. They would never, ever, ever overhype themselves. It's not in their genetic possibility. Literally, if I said to them, I need you to overhype, they still wouldn't even get close to the right amount of hype. Let me just put it that way. There's no way they can do it. Like, it's not possible for them. So I get to say, look, I need you to push it on your marketing a lot more than you're doing. And if I say that to them, they're still not even going to get to the point where it's too much. So, because most people hold themselves back. It's just part of the game. So, yeah.
Ed, if people want to learn more about you and maybe get some more of that energy that you're putting out, what can they do?
Yeah, so my homeplate is edrush.com. Easiest website to remember. Even if you're riding a motorcycle right now on the Isle of Skye and you just heard me say edrush.com, It's six letters, edrush.com. You can remember that. If you hop on there, I send out an email most of the time every week, not every week, but most weeks. Massive content-based email with a lot of information. I have a show that goes, it's moving into its second season now, which I'd love to invite you to come watch. And then, yeah, I do events and that sort of thing. So hit me up there. There's a place to shoot me an email. Those emails get to me, by the way. I see everything that comes through. I'd love to hear that you heard me here on George's awesome podcast on Your Intended Message. And yeah, dude, it was awesome to be on the show too. Thank you.
Yeah, you'll find him at edrush.com. And in case you can't remember that, the link is in the description below. You'll find it there. My guest today is Ed Rush, reminding you that one can fail kindergarten and still fly an F-18.
If you like what you heard, remember to like, comment, and share this podcast. Come back every week for more practical insights to help you deliver your intended message. I'm your host, George Torok.